you've got to build up a grassroots movement before those people in elected positions are going to listen to you.
We need to think about the Iraqis who are killed. They're not Saddam Hussein.
We protest in the street, we lobby in the streets, and we vote in polling places around the country.
If the U.S. does go to war, there's going to be serious turmoil because there are so many people that oppose it.
There's this irony that when you go to war against the tyrant, you kill the victims of the tyrant.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, November 4th, 2002. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When representatives in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate voted overwhelmingly weeks ago to pass the Bush administration's resolution to attack Iraq, hundreds of thousands of Americans were outraged that their elected representatives were blatantly ignoring their will to oppose Bush's war against Iraq. Many vowed to fight back with the ballot, and analysts speculated that Iraq war votes could cost some officials their position. On this eve of the 2002 midterm elections, what impact might the Iraq war resolution vote have on the overall outcome? Pacifica's political and national affairs analyst Larry Bensky is following the congressional races closely. Larry, what are the chances the Democrats, who are the minority party in the House, will regain that body on Tuesday?
It's not very likely at all, Verna, and the reason is that the Republicans have followed a brilliant, if cynical, election strategy, which is, for the last couple of months, they've managed, with the guidance of the White House and the assistance of the corporate media, to focus the nation's political attention, such as it is, on the question of a possible war with Iraq. And that has completely sucked the air out of any possibility that the election would be fought on grounds that are more favorable to the Democrats, i.e. the corporate corruption scandals, the collapse of the stock markets and people's pension plans and savings for college, the increasing fragility of the health care system, and the menaces to Social Security, all of which would have worked and in some cases have worked for Democrats in the past. But this time, the media attention and the administration's political attention focusing very successfully on the question of military action against Iraq has forced the Democrats to basically be a split and relatively silent party. And in that sense, the Republicans have already succeeded in winning this election. Even if the seats that they have go down or up by a few, it's not going to be the type of traditional off-year election gains by the party out of power.
How, then, is this whole issue about the war against Iraq and the passing of the war resolutions, is there going to be a downside for Democrats in terms of are the constituents likely to vote against Democrats or stay home and sit it out because the Democrats, you couldn't tell the Democrats from the Republicans in terms of who voted for the war resolution and who didn't?
There's been a lot of discontent in the Democratic Party's liberal base, which is its base, about what the Democrats did during the Iraq war resolution debate. The fact that the leadership in the House, Dick Gephardt, and later on in the Senate, Tom Daschle, basically went along with the Bush administration, thereby leaving no opposition, effectively, in a two-party system. I think the choices you laid out, the one that many people are going to be choosing, is to stay home on Election Day. And that is an increasingly popular choice among the United States public. We're going to have something like perhaps 35% to 40% of the potential eligible voters show up to vote in this election, which means close to two-thirds of the people who could have voted won't bother to vote. Now, the question is always, if everybody did vote, would the election results be very different? And there's an interesting new book called The Vanishing Voter by Thomas Paterson at the Kennedy Institute at Harvard. He contends that the people who could change things socially and economically in this country are the very ones who aren't voting, and that increasingly wealthier, older people dominate by a margin of over 2-to-1 against younger, poorer people, of all ethnicities, by the way, when it comes to being represented at the voting booths. And so, therefore, the fact that so many people will continue to stay home means that the system will continue to be what it is.
Are people likely to vote against a particular Democrat because he voted for the war resolution?
The only one that was thought to be in danger on that level was Paul Wellstone. And, of course, his tragic disappearance took that out of the equation. On the other hand, what's happened in Minnesota since then, including today when the governor appointed an independent party member to Wellstone's unexpired seat, and it's not even clear how long that person will be sitting because opinions differ as to when the new person who's elected, whether it's Walter Mondale or his opponent Norm Coleman, wins the election. It's unclear whether this newly appointed guy named Dean Barkley will be in the Senate for days or weeks or possibly months. But it's indicative of how bitter and divided a state can get over the question of electoral participation, which is really something that needs to be discussed and isn't being discussed nearly sufficiently in this country. Jesse Ventura today said that he appointed Dean Barkley because he was angry at the fact that the Democrats had used Wellstone's funeral, some of them, as a kind of a campaign rally. However, he was even angrier at the fact that the Independence Party candidate for senator, and there is one in Minnesota, was not invited to today's debate between Walter Mondale and Norm Coleman. There's also a Green Party candidate in that race who was mm-hmm. not invited to the debate. And this is something
or offered the position in the Senate, I would imagine.
No, not offered the position in the Senate either.
But Ventura is of the Independent Party.
Right. He's an Independent Party member. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this is getting so contentious and inside politics, inside baseball type of fighting is further turning people off to the electoral system all around the country. If this was happening in a country like Venezuela or Chile or a country in Africa, Verna, the United States media would be full of cluck-cluck stories about how unstable the system is there, and why don't they learn how to do a real democracy? Mm-hmm. Well, in this country, we are having an increasingly unstable situation where we don't know how to do a real democracy. Electoral reform was supposed to be on the agenda after the debacle in Florida 2 years ago, and what have we got? Campaign finance reform that last week, there was a story in the New York Times, both the Democrats and Republicans have figured out a way around the ban on soft money, and they're raising just as much money as ever before. Even voting machines, we don't have better voting machines than we used to have anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention things like instant runoff voting and proportional representation and things like that that should be being considered. So we've got a very broken electoral system in this country, and I think that's something that we need to look at a lot more.
Well, getting back to the war and the anti-war movement and its expectations and hopes for this election, we know that the anti-war movement would love to have an impact on the races of Democrats who voted for the president's war resolution. But what are the chances it will, realistically?
It's too soon for the extra electoral peace movement in this country to have organized itself into an electoral form. For one thing, the kind of people who organize the demonstrations, like we just recently had and broadcast in Washington and San Francisco, are people who are not inside the electoral system. They have a disdain for it, if not a total dismissal for it. And they see the necessity of building up an independent movement as a peace movement in this country. It's the same thing we saw in the civil rights movement in the 60s and the anti-war movement in the 60s and 70s, Verna. The fact that the people who are in power now are implementing the kind of policies that they're trying to do in Iraq means they're the last people to try to get the message to. You've got to build up a grassroots movement before those people in elected positions are going to listen to you. And so it's much too soon since the Bush administration really started pushing this Iraq stuff in early September. The anti-war movement has responded pretty quickly, but it's much too soon for them to be putting a lot of electoral pressure on candidates. Having said that, the anti-war movement successfully mobilized hundreds of thousands of people to communicate with their elected representatives' offices during the debate on Iraq in Congress. And I listened to, as we were broadcasting on many stations, the debate in the House, and there wasn't one single member of the House, no matter which side he or she was voting on, who said, "My constituents have called me up and said they're really for the war." Overwhelmingly, the communications they were receiving, even people who voted, wholeheartedly for the Iraq resolution, for President Bush's resolution, We know that their offices were being deluged with people from their constituencies who were opposed to the stand they were taking. However, in a kind of electoral system we have, where money determines so much of what positions get taken and how they get taken, it was much too soon for the anti-war movement to begin to have the traction necessary to make itself felt in this election. And that is too bad, because there is not going to be another election where, should the Bush administration go forward with anything like its present plans for Iraq, that the people can express themselves until 2 years from now. There's no way they can express themselves if all the candidates that they have a choice of, Democrat and Republican, in many cases,
are taking
the same position on the Iraq war, plus the fact that, you know, of 435 races in the House, only about a dozen now are said to be competitive as we're going into the last day, and you put a few more upsets in there, you figure maybe it's 20. But that's not a lot out of 435 because of the way the districts have been gerrymandered. And then in the Senate, where we have 34 races up, there are only about six that are thought to be competitive because of the way incumbents have the money and the power to protect themselves. So the system right now, the two-party system, is broken on a lot of levels, and it's manifesting itself in a lack of clear choice, which is not one of the elements that we like to think of as part of a democracy. I would say the chances for the Democrats hanging on to the Senate right now are 50-50, but in any case, they're not going to have the 60 votes, which is a magic number that you need in the Senate to cut off a filibuster, or will the Republicans? It's not so much a question of who's going to retain control of the Senate, although that's important, but it's a question of how and when is any pressure going to be put on these bodies to reform themselves. There's no serious movement right now that is forcing the elected officials to consider that, and therefore they're not considering it.
Pacifica political and national affairs analyst Larry Binsky. The Bush administration is trying once more to win the UN Security Council votes of France, Russia, and China, or at least to prevent a veto with yet another rewording of a draft resolution for weapons inspections in Iraq. Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York has been following the latest developments at the UN and files this report.
Under the latest proposal, the draft would soften language, declaring Iraq to be in, quote, material breach, quote, in the event of disputes during the new inspection process. But there's a catch. The U.S. would retain language continuing to assert that Iraq is already in material breach of pre-existing U.N. resolutions, leaving unchanged Washington's assertion that military force could be invoked whenever President Bush sees fit. Michael Ratner is president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he says the use of the term material breach is crucial in determining whether there will be an invasion of Iraq.
Here's the way it works. There are two major resolutions out there. There's the resolution that allowed the war to go on to begin with in 1990, 678. Then there's the resolution that was the ceasefire and included inspection terms, 687. If the current resolution before the UN says somehow that Iraq has breached 687 or other resolutions relating to inspection and uses the word material breach, the argument is then open to the United States to say, well, if you had a material breach of the ceasefire with Iraq, then that ceasefire is no longer in effect, and we, the United States, can go back to the use of force resolution, number 678, which is still there. 678 was passed in 1990, and it's like a loaded gun at the head of Iraq. So the United States is very anxious to have the language material breach, allows them to get rid of the ceasefire resolution and all the other ones, and go back to the use of force resolution. It's really a ridiculous argument.
According to Ratner, Resolution 678 is moot since its terms of force were premised on Iraq's then occupation of Kuwait, a condition which no longer obtains. Furthermore, Ratner says, the final force decision remains with the United Nations and not the United States.
It's not up to individual countries. Can you imagine? Tomorrow, Guatemala decides Israel's in material breach of one of the many UN resolutions. Does that give any country in the world to stop bombing Israel? Of course it doesn't. The UN has to do two things. First, it has to decide that Iraq is in material breach, and secondly, it has to decide the consequences. The U.S. is insisting on another way to do this, put in material breach, that it materially breached the ceasefire, then it opens the use of force resolution from 1990. None of it makes any sense. I'm just hopeful that these countries, which have obviously seen it, France has seen that coming, can resist more than by just simply not saying anything, but can actually exercise a veto. That would be the best of all circumstances.
The White House has already asserted that a UN resolution is moot, given a domestic authorization for force passed by Congress last month. The new draft could be submitted to the full Security Council as early as Tuesday, with a possible vote by the end of the week. Meanwhile, Chief UN Inspector Hans Blix met this weekend with Iraqi Ambassador Mohammed al-Duri, who said that he still thinks the UN will be used as a tool for America to attack his country. But in Baghdad today, President Saddam Hussein indicated flexibility, telling Germany's visiting foreign minister that, quote, if a resolution is issued which respects the UN Charter, international law, and Iraq's sovereignty, security, and independence, and does not provide a cover for America's ill intentions, we will view it in a way that makes us deal with it, end quote. In New York, I'm Robert Knight.
While the country is getting ready to re-elect its political officials, anti-war activists are calling on voters to go to the polls, to the White House, to the council, or to wear red ribbons symbolizing support of those few candidates who voted against Bush's war resolution. Reem Kathuda, Pacifica's Peace Watch reporter from WPFW in Washington, has more in this report.
Hundreds of thousands of people are voicing their opposition to a war against Iraq in the United States. They are holding rallies and teach-ins. They're analyzing Bush's administration's drive behind this buildup as the U.S. local economy is in trouble, and they are documenting and amplifying the backlashes that they see ahead for both the USA and the innocent Iraqis. They call the representatives in a ratio documented to have reached 300-1 against the war. They marched on the offices of their representatives, on the White House. They sang, wrote poetry, yelled, locked down, and many were arrested trying to stop this war. They have passed union, council, and city resolutions against this build-up for a war, and more resolutions are being considered. Anti-war activists and average Joes who became anti-war activists out of rage since this build-up for what they call an unjust war are challenging Bush's administration's call for war in the streets, on the radios, and in the internet. A few activists believed by now that Congress is irrelevant and that what is most important are mass movements whose purpose is to create change in this country, not through the political process, but through mass action. Others from all over the country are trying to figure out how to get people more involved in the political process to stop this war. Some held, just last Thursday, a quiet and purposeful demo of people against a war on Iraq, quoting the Bible commandment, "Thou shall not kill," and equating it with no war. Others are calling for a red ribbon campaign to, quote, "let our government see a river of red ribbons and maybe prevent rivers of blood." Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney is calling on the progressives to inundate the Hill with their presence, the way special interest inundates the Hill with their money. She said it is lonely on the Hill and that the few progressive voices there really need the support of a mass movement. Many activists are working on a local level, calling on all to push for resolutions against the war. Petitions are being circulated in support of a D.C. Council resolution condemning U.S. unilateral action against Iraq. One such petition documents that the cost of a war with Iraq could exceed $100 billion, that the bill that President Bush signed on October 30th will give $335 billion to the defense budget, money that will cause yet another round of budget cuts for education, health care, and other social programs. The D.C. Council is expected to vote on this resolution on November 7th. Global Exchange, Black Voices for Peace, the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation are among those supporting a national action from a local level. They call to support the lawmakers that have voted against the resolution of a war on Iraq. Damu Smith from Black Voices for Peace is urging all people of conscience to participate in the system, to go to the polls tomorrow and cast a vote for peace with justice at home and abroad.
Participating in the political system in this country means that we protest in the street, we lobby in the suite, and we vote in polling places around the country. We came out by the thousands, Americans, young and old, of all races, a couple of weeks ago in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., saying no to war, yes to human needs, and justice here and abroad. Now we must march to the polling booths on tomorrow and cast our ballots, and we should not cast a single vote for any candidate that voted for the war and that continues to vote against human needs. Get out and let people know about those candidates' records. Get out the vote effort at the local level, at the state level, and at the county level to get our candidates out.
As for what to do in D.C., Smith points out that a combination of poor economic management and high enlistment makes voting for those against the war on Iraq a major issue.
We have no voting representation in Congress, yet we have the highest percentage of people who died in the Vietnam War. We have a very high percentage of people in the National Guard and in armed services who are stationed abroad. So we, the people of the District of Columbia, have a direct stake in the outcome of any decisions to go to war. We pay higher taxes than anyone else in the country, yet we have no voting representation in Congress, and we're being asked to go and fight a criminal war that has no basis in morality or ethics. The system is not working in D.C. with the people we currently have in charge. There's more poverty in the district. There's less affordable housing in the district. There's less jobs in the district for people to have access to. There needs to be a change. So my advice to people tomorrow in the District of Columbia is to go to the polls and vote against those people who have created this problem. Vote for new faces, new individuals, new parties that can help make a difference and move us in a different direction with a new vision and a new reality. We've got to say no to the war, yes to statehood, yes to a new vision of what D.C. ought to be about in terms of jobs, income, and peace.
Andrea Buffa from Global Exchange reiterates the call for all to participate to stop this war against Iraq.
It's really important that people participate in every way that they're able to participate. That means voting, that means getting out on the street and protesting, that means doing nonviolent direct actions when that's required for. That means writing articles to the newspaper, whatever people possibly can do. I think it's really important that people get out tomorrow on Election Day and both vote to kick out the warmonger candidates, the candidates who think that supporting a war is actually going to get them elected. And it's also important to get out and use that opportunity to educate the public about a possible war in Iraq, about why a war in Iraq would be something really, really terrible, and about which politicians are the ones who supported that war, probably thinking that it was to their political benefit. Election Day is a really great opportunity to educate people because many people are already going out to the ballots. And so what people can do is very simple. They could go out with a table and sit outside a voting station. They could hand out anti-war flyers. They could, for example, at Global Exchange, we're going to be bringing out ballot boxes to some of the voting stations in San Francisco and giving people a ballot and having them vote yes or no on war, giving them an opportunity to directly vote on war. Or they could do something as simple as creating a banner and standing out in public near a polling station that says, money for jobs, not for war, vote for the anti-war candidate. And it's fairly easy to figure out in your district who that person is. On Global Exchange's website, unitedforpeace.org, click on the resources for organizing. We have the links to websites that will show you which senators and which representatives voted to support Bush's war against Iraq.
Buffa, like Damu Smith, thinks that the local candidate's position on the war is crucial.
the local politicians can stand with the public in trying to pressure and push the national politicians to do the right thing. There's a lot of city councils that have been passing anti-war resolutions, and the more of those that we have, the more we're going to show that there's a grassroots opposition to the war, and that if the U.S. does go to war, there's going to be serious turmoil because there are so many people that oppose it.
People tomorrow are going to be voting for borough presidents, for mayors, for council people, for governors. How can people know which candidate on a local level supports stopping this war?
You can call the offices of the candidates to find out. You can ask whether, if there was a city council resolution to support or oppose a war on Iraq, how did, for example, that city council member vote on that? But at this point, I think people just have to get out and do a little bit of basic research for themselves. Either call the local newspaper, call the candidate's office, and ask how they voted or how they would vote or what is their position on the war in Iraq. And if they support it, get out there to the polling place, stand there with a banner and say, you know, vote against this candidate. We want to put our money toward jobs, toward improving the economy, not toward war.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Kathouda.
With so much debate and attention being focused on the impending war against Iraq, commentators Ralph Shulman and Maya Schoen say there's a great secret war being waged that's just below the public's radar.
The Los Angeles Times published an instructive article on October 27th by William M. Arkin entitled The Secret War, in which Arkin exposes that the U.S. Defense Department is dramatically expanding its black world of covert operations in what may well be the largest expansion of covert action by the armed forces since the Vietnam War. The Defense Department is building up an elite secret army with resources stretching across the full spectrum of covert capabilities. The increasingly dominant role of the military reflects the desire of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to gain absolute control. This is an expansion of the Pentagon's covert operations known as the Intelligence Support Activity, or ISA, that built its reputation, as the article describes it, for daring and flexibility and lawlessness.
The ISA operates today under the codename Gray Fox. It's part of a secret sphere that includes the CIA's Paramilitary Special Activities Division and the Pentagon's Joint Special Operations Command. Its low-profile eavesdropping planes fly without military markings and work closely with the special forces and the CIA. It also has the technical expertise to tap into cell phones anywhere. The epicenter of the Pentagon's covert operations remains the North Carolina-based Joint Special Operations Command, known to us as Delta Force. The super-secret command is still not officially acknowledged to exist. Its two-star commander, Army Major General Del Daley, has no public biography.
In fact, Rumsfeld's Defense Science Board in 2002 prepared a study on special operations and joint forces for, quote, countering terrorism, with a guide to all Pentagon agencies to institute strategies, postures, and organization through the creation of a clandestine superintelligence support activity dubbed the Proactive Preemptive Operations Group, or P2OG. This will now launch provocations called secret operations aimed at stimulating reactions not only among its nominal targets across the world, but specifically from the American people themselves.
When Bush and Cheney speak of 60 countries, that's one-third the membership of the United Nations, in which the permanent war will unfold, they have in mind provocations and false flag operations to provide the pretext for the next phase of the secret war. This is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.
Commentators Ralph Shulman and Maya Schoen are hosts of Taking Aim. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be right back.